choir master has my perch. Latvians have a big tradition of singing. They have a song festival. They used to have one every 4 years in the diaspora before the Soviet Empire fell. They used to have it in Maple Leaf Gardens in Toronto. And now they have them in the, outside of Latvia and in Latvia. And I saw a video of one about 8 years ago. It was big festival, big song festival, and what they do is they publish a songbook and distribute it to all the parishes in Latvia and abroad, to any parish that wants to participate, and each parish has a choir, and then they come together, they practice individually, and they come together in this big festival, and they're all in their national costumes, which are really beautiful, and the choir I saw was 11,000 people, just my little fuzz would stand up, and they have different choir masters go up on an elevated scaffolding, about two three stories high, and I mean they look like they're just really getting off on it. Quite nice. My father was in a men's choir, and he's very very resourceful. Because in those first years after the war, they were refugees in Germany, and the American army to take care of this huge population of refugees from Eastern Europe, they billeted them with the Germans. So the first few years of my life, I was living with a German family. I don't remember them. I'm sure it wasn't very pleasant. They kind of plunked down one family in one room. But so there's no employment. So my dad's very resourceful, so they put together a men's choir, and they just tour the various refugee towns and sang and made a bit of money that way. So my dad, he was a hi-fi buff, and he loved choral music. He always had choral music, and he played it so loud the windows would shake. So we finally banned him, and he had to get earphones. It was so loud. He had a very good baritone voice. But that's really not why we're here, are we? Little aside. I think Ajahn Kuslo comes from a musical family. His sister has a perfect ear. She plays like harpsichord, piano, organ. She's a very, very good pianist. And his father had a very good voice. So, Pavro, we'll get to you later. So, Buddhism. Where are we? Yesterday we left off. Yeah, the monk was dealing with his sugar addiction, right? Dealing with that. So if we consider, it's a good way to consider social Buddhism and flow of consciousness Buddhism, one way to look at it. So that chant we did this morning, that extra chant, that's the way consciousness is described through the five khandhas, or in Sanskrit, the five skandhas. But in social Buddhism, it's really based on mutual responsibility. So rather than having a charter of rights, you'd have a charter of responsibilities. And charter of rights, of course, implies a charter of responsibilities. I think we could introduce it. And a Buddhist charter of responsibilities would then also entail a charter of animal rights, because the attitude to any sentient being is one of compassion. So the texts that talk about social life in Buddhism are not that detailed, but there's a lot of commentary that's come down through the ages. But what's always very obvious is they talk about mutual responsibility, so the responsibility of parent to child and child to parent, of teacher to pupil, pupil to teacher, of husband to wife, wife to husband, of ruler to rule, to the government, to the populace, and the populace to the government. So there's this mutual responsibility. It's really quite beautiful. It's based on. So as monastics, we don't have any rights, but we have responsibilities, which then, of course, means that there are rights. And so we're taught a lot of social responsibility. Again, we don't, like the teachings on emptiness, then, like say, like a young monk wouldn't send him out to the woods to go meditate on emptiness, because he'd probably go bonkers. First of all, teach him how to wash his bowl, and then teach him how to sew his robes, and then teach him how to put on his robes, and then take care of his teacher. So, say in England, or in our monasteries generally, when a man or a woman want to take the robe, the first year is a year of service. They wear white and they serve the community. Generosity, just develop that. And certainly within that, there are teachings on emptiness or lots of opportunity for meditation. But the idea is one of service. And just the sort of basics of being a monastic, just the nitty-gritty. So one establishes a good sense of being a person, a good, wholesome sense of being a person. And again, that's crucial to the higher understandings. Otherwise, the foundation's all very, very shaky. And so all those things I've been talking about, the attitudes of the heart, generosity, gratitude, kindness, compassion, otherwise the whole Buddhist thing can seem like another self-serving ego project, can't it? I'm getting enlightened for me, which is a contradiction in terms. And then the ethical basis, and all of that. And that's the context of a retreat. That's all very, very necessary part of it. But a retreat is a different, it's a different opportunity where, again, you're sitting in the vehicle. Ajahn Sumedho used to give these, you have Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana, and then you have the joke in Tricycle? Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, all vehicles will be towed away. But he used to kind of talk, he'd say, well, you're just sitting in this vehicle. It's a Volkswagen, you don't need a Rolls. It's Hinayana, it's okay. And you just sit and you watch. And you just watch and see the scenery go by. And that's one of the principles of a retreat. As I was saying yesterday, you set up a format in which one doesn't have the freedom of distraction, but one has the freedom to watch the desire for distraction. And that's a kind of very special thing, to have that kind of situation where we're safe, we're cared for, we have a lovely environment, where we can just witness to the way things are in a simple format. And so saying last night, just kind of giving up to it and seeing what happens, it can be quite edifying, liking, disliking. So there's a couple of questions here, three really. One is kind of related. Maybe I'll try to approach those. If there is no self, then what is there? Some suggestions about methods for increasing equanimity, and then some discussion of, there's a teaching called "In the Herd, There Is Just the Herd." Let me talk about that. That first question, if there is no self, then what is there, is one of the great misunderstandings of the Buddhist teachings. because when the, I think the this question is only found directly in the there's only one instance, if I might be wrong, I think I read that from Tanisiro, where in the text the Buddha is asked directly, is there a self? And he didn't answer that. So one of the the whole method of questioning in Buddhism is very important. But what's very important is the right kind of question. So the Buddha would answer a question directly, or he might rephrase the question, he might put a counter question, or he might ignore the question. So some things he didn't answer. So where this, what the teaching, if there was no self, you just feel like this kind of nihilistic teaching, you think, yeah, but there's something going on, and certainly my knee hurt this morning. So that would kind of just get you very, very confused. But if you said that anything that changed is you, the self implies a kind of fixed thing. So if you said the body is self, well, which body? Was it the body that was there yesterday or today? So the teaching actually is the teaching on no self, and it was in that chanting this morning, is that in the khandhas, you will not find a fixed soul or entity or thing. And so the khandhas describe the mind-body process. So in that chanting we did, we'll do it again tomorrow morning, but and this is the way we often learn, by the way, in monasteries. We just go through this chanting and you start to pick it all up. So in brief, the five focuses of the grasping mind are dukkha. So identification with the body, identification with feeling, identification with perception, identification with mental formations, identification with consciousness. Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana. And that, those five you find in all Buddhist traditions in the Tibetan they use skandhas, don't they? It's the Sanskrit term. And then it says, the body is impermanent, yeah. Feeling is impermanent, perception is impermanent, mental formations are impermanent, consciousness is impermanent. The body is not self. So it doesn't say there is no self as an absolute principle. The body is not self, feeling is not self, perception is not self, mental formations are not self, consciousness is not self. So that's the way you have to, there's a difference there. It's not like an absolute thing that there is no self, which would be a nihilistic teaching of nothing. But it says that in the body you won't find a fixed thing, because self in this way implies there's some kind of a fixed entity, fixed thing. So the questioning that the Buddha suggests is, okay, then if the body is self, then observe the body and find that self. So just observe body, can you find it? And of course as you do that and you have enough stability of mind, as you do that you notice it's always changing, it's always shifting. Then feeling, vedana is the sense of attraction or repulsion that we have around sense consciousness. So we, you know, most of us are probably attracted by that lovely choir music because it's attractive. Most of us are not attracted by our painful knees. We're repelled by that. So there's this kind of push-pull going on in sense consciousness, which is called vedana. Dukkha vedana, sukha vedana, and neutrality. So it's a pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. So the word vedana, or feeling, is not as broad a term as you would find in normal English language. Feeling can mean emotions, but it's that specific aspect of consciousness, push-pull. And that also, the Buddha says, okay, in that, is there a fixed thing called a self? And you observe, and you observe, and it's changing, coming and going. So, well, no, they can't find a fixed thing called self in that. And then perceptions, the way we perceive the world, we interpret the world, through perceptions built up on memory, you observe that. Are any perceptions fixed? They change. Then the sankhara, the mental formations, you observe that. Can you find a fixed self in that? They change. Consciousness itself, sound, sight, and the six senses, observe that. They change. And that's the way the Buddha suggests insight takes place. So in terms of vipassana meditation, this is it's a kind of questioning of some kind of assumption. Now certainly there is a sense of presence here. You can't deny that. There's something going on. And there is a sense of individuality. Certainly your mind is different than my mind, each of our bodies. So there is a sense of individuality going on. So the idea in Buddhist insight meditation is to first of all establish the stability of mind, get that really, really stable, and a stability of living, like live a good life, so that there's no regret and no remorse, and simplify things as much as possible. So that's what we've done in the retreat. We're practicing sense restraint, Indriya Samvara, which is very, very helpful for settling things down. So we're also practicing santuti, contentment with little, just being content is good enough. Work with that. So we create the factors for helping the mind to settle down, to be stable, and then from that stability, then one can pose these questions about the sense of self. Now, the question, "Who am I?" would be unskillful in Buddhism, because it could be unskillful, not necessarily, but if it just got into trying to speculate, "Who am I?" then you'd just be caught into the thinking realm. So the way the Buddha formulates this inquiry is, okay, take these assumptions that you have about the body, the mind-body experience, and find a self in it then. Find it. Go for it. And through that inquiry, the mind begins to just notice change. And as the mind notices change, then there comes a time where the very fact of noticing becomes interesting. Yeah? And the mind needs a lot of stability, it needs a lot of strength, but the very fact, well, that's all changing. If there is a sense of a self, if there is a self, and that's got to be something that doesn't change, that's the sort of reasoning that goes on. And then the inquiry turns on itself. Who's inquiring? Now that's not done as an attempt to figure it out through thought, because there is no answer that way. But it's more done through the silent curiosity of who's in the control tower, who's running the show, whatever way you want to put it. And that takes a lot of silence. And that kind of awareness, looking at awareness, is where the deepest insights come, where the sense of duality falls away, and where the deathless is realized. So we say awareness is the gateway to the deathless. Now, what that experience of Nibbana is, in terms of self or no self, it's really not defined that way. It's not held that way, because those words have a sort of assumption around them. So it's defined as the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unborn. And the way one comes to that is through the disillusionment with the five khandhas. So the five khandhas are the one way of defining the mind-body process. You could do it many ways, I suppose. You could say mind-body, you could say psychophysical process, whatever you wanted to, but it's the experiential part of our life. And so what happens with the mind which has not realized the deathless, it's forever seeking fulfillment in that which changes, in the body, in feeling, in perceptions, in mental formations, or in consciousness. So that's why that's happening, is because of the pleasure pain principle. We seek pleasure and we don't want displeasure. So as long as the project is the maximization of pleasure and minimization of displeasure, then the project will have some modicum of success, but it won't be the deathless, because pleasure in itself is conditioned and we don't control it, and it comes and goes according to other factors. So the disillusionment with pleasure, and that sounds strange, it's not the rejection of pleasure, but seeing that that pleasure-pain principle itself is unstable, and no longer being interested in that is a movement inwards. And there's a sense of kind of samvega, and which sort of a sense of that it's not there, it can't be there. So the interest has to be in the deathless. If it's truly a spiritual project and one is interested in, say, the Buddha's realization, it can't be just the maximization of pleasure. So meditation can be used for, you know, having a happier life, which is fine, which is great, because it's a really nice thing to do. But if it's going to be on an authentic kind of Buddhist investigation, then there has to be this kind of curiosity about the Buddha's realization. And so the words deathless, uncreated, unoriginated, unformed become very, very important, because one sees that that which is created and formed, which comes and goes, can't be it. It can't be the body. So one has to find a sense of equanimity with the body. Otherwise, my attention is always caught up with bodily pleasure. It might be sexuality, it might be the pleasantness of food or whatever, but one is always looking for pleasure. So there comes a sense of renunciation. And renunciation isn't rejection, it's a disinterest. Not in a kind of way where one can't enjoy a bit of singing during the meditation. It doesn't come from aversion or hatred. It comes from that can't be it. It doesn't mean one doesn't not enjoy it, but it just that can't be it. So all that energy which one might have put into sense pleasure, no, I want to put my energy somewhere else, you see. And then one can still put on whatever you like and play it on your CD, but that's not the prime project anymore. The worldly project is power, success, and so on, but the spiritual project, the whole sense realm becomes, you see it in a kind of right relationship, because pleasure in itself is limited. So because our sense experience has this hook of the pleasant and unpleasant, that's the hook, and that you can't get around, that's kind of the way it works, what arises is the craving for the pleasant and the aversion to the unpleasant. And what arises from that is a whole structures and patterns that we get caught up into. And we totally engaged with the sense consciousness. We are preoccupied with that. And so part of our practice is just disengagement. Now when we learn to disengage from that, we face a difficulty, and the difficulty is that we have to sit through unfulfilled desire. So you like, let's say if I've always been a shy person, and then whenever I felt that shyness come into consciousness, that's unpleasant, right? And I've created a sense of self around that. Oh, I don't want to do this, or blah, 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 whatever the language has, and it's become a pattern. That pattern's become fixed in the mind as a sense of me and other. And then each time the shyness comes up, I back off. I have to, at some point, say no. I'm going to witness the shyness. And that's counter to the ego craving which I have developed, isn't it? You know, it's I'm going against something that has allowed me to survive, but I'm not terribly happy, because every time it comes up I have to run away. So I face my fears. And now I'm going into the unpleasant now. Yeah? I'm going into the unpleasant because I'm willing to watch craving. I'm not willing to seek an escape from craving anymore, from that fear. I'm willing to watch unfulfilled desire. And that's the really hard bit of the spiritual life, is to witness to unfulfilled desire. And not just in ways of giving up Coca-Cola. It's more profound than that. It's the ways of the ego that come up. But what happens if I do that? If I the way I've faced a lot of my craving is around fears by giving talks. Well, what happens with that is that your whole, like, just going into something that you're afraid of, say, okay, so you have to give a talk. So tomorrow, you know, we'll put the seat up and you'll give the talk tomorrow. And then you start planning and thinking and giving a talk. And you find you've given four talks in the first hour. And it's only the morning meditation. And then you go to the books and you take notes. And all of that's driven by fear. It's just driven by fear. Not all of it. Sometimes it's good planning. But let's say a lot of it is maybe driven by fear. But and then you go and you look at the fears you have to give the talk. What does that do? It means that the usual refuge I've sought in getting away from the fear, which has been in running away or distracting myself somehow in sense experience, I no longer go in that direction. I stick it out. And because I stick it out, as that fear comes up and the craving to run away from the fear, I look at that, the sense of stillness becomes stronger because I'm no longer a victim to that particular desire wrapped around fear. And I do it in all kinds of ways. And I keep doing it and doing it and doing it. So the still center of knowing becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. And so the stability of mind becomes stronger, and hence equanimity. And equanimity then becomes a basis for the really deep investigation of mind, kind of calmness of mind. Now, in terms of developing equanimity, it kind of depends, the question depends where you're at. So if we go back to our young monk in the monastery and the sugar problem, if you look what I had developed over, what was it, about 25, went into the monastery, I had developed a capacity to do what I want. I'd learned how to eat what I want, go when I felt restless, and all the, you know, the sensual things were available to me. Plus, I was shy. So the equipment I had, I went into the monastery, was a lot of inspiration, but not a very well-trained mind. And then I plunked myself down into this rather austere form of monasticism, and of course what happens, my mind starts screaming, give me yogurt, let alone other things. Give me Jimi Hendrix, give me something. And now, why is that? Well, because that's what my mind has done. It's always, whenever it felt restless or whenever desire came up, it absorbed into sense experience, into the five khandhas, into that which was pleasurable. And when it was displeasurable, it went somewhere else. And that was the conditioning of the mind. And then when all of those outlets for craving were no longer there, then the only outlet was the meal. That was it. And the amount of suffering it's hard to describe a young 24-year-old man filled with testosterone who's played around, done everything, being faced with a meal of sticky rice and what his mind can do with that, it's indescribable. And before, I didn't think I had a food problem. I just ate. I wanted halava, I ate halava. I wanted milk, I drank milk. There was one time where I was new to the monastery, and Ajahn Chah would get invited for meals in the town, so that someone would have some celebration, and Ajahn Chah would be invited, and he would bring usually six monks with him. And I'd heard about this. I was just a novice, so novices usually weren't invited. And And they're really, really kind of lavish feeds, whereas in the monastery it was pretty grim sometimes. So one day I found my name on the chalkboard, and my mind just went ape. I couldn't stop my mind. It just kept fantasizing. Shut up. So we went off in the truck to the town, and I just lost it. I just filled my bowl. Just anything I could get. And it was the worst meal of my life. You know, I was greedy and I was embarrassed. So then we're going back to the monastery. I'm sitting in the truck feeling, you know, so I was very idealistic, right? I'm going to get enlightened and all that. I can't even handle a meal. And I'm sitting there kind of really dejected. And Ajahn Chah looks at me and says, "What's wrong?" He says, "Oh, I still like food." He says, "Oh, so do I." So equanimity at that point in my life was survival, basically. Can I make it through another day? So equanimity rather depends on where your head's at, or where your heart's at, or where your palate is at. So for me, at that point, the cravings were so strong, I just needed really good boundaries and a lot of encouragement from the teacher. You know, just encouraged me to just hang in there. So I couldn't, you know, I had no subtle insights about these things. But after the kind of first crazy few months, I began to get a hold of it. Okay, it's just the meal, watch your mind. And then I could see the anticipation for the meal, and I could just keep watching greed for food. And of course, the beauty of it was that was the only avenue for greed, because there was really nothing else. There was no coffee or tea, or there were no English-speaking books to speak of, and English written, and there was no music, and oftentimes I was the only Westerner, so really, there really was very little sense of pleasure. So actually it was quite good, because the whole thing about the greed in the mind became very, very obvious. And so how do you develop equanimity? Well, first of all, having a lifestyle which allows you to see things is helpful. Having a lifestyle where there is repetition and routine is actually very, very helpful. Because if one can see a certain defilement arising again and again and again in a certain situation, you get repetition. And that's what I discovered in monastic life, was the repetition was certainly boring. And I certainly would have liked Jimi Hendrix to Sticky Rice. But I wouldn't have learned anything. Whereas here I had the same problem, and although in the beginning it was overwhelming, I began to get a hold of it. And I began to see, this is greed arising, this is anticipation arising. And once that objectivity gets established, then of course it's much easier. When we're overwhelmed by situations, we just lose it, really, kind of survive. So that's where you need good precepts. But then when the defilements arise of greed, hatred, or delusion, then what do you do? Well, it arises because of the conditioned mind. So how do you develop equanimity? Well, first of all, you accept the arising of the defilement, right? Because that's the beginning of equanimity, because equanimity is acceptance. So if I can accept the arising of the fear mind, or the shyness mind, or the fantasizing mind, or I can really accept it objectively, you know, this is the fantasizing mind, it feels that way, then that's the beginning of equanimity, isn't it? Mind still does that, but what I've put into the stream of consciousness now is acceptance. Not indulgence, in which case I just think about it, not rejection, but actual acceptance. This is the way it is now. And just that seed, then a million times, leads to equanimity. So for me, around shyness and the fear of giving talks, just that. Just feel the guts, feel the anxiety, feel the anticipation, go give the talk. A million times. Just keep giving the talk. So that the main thing is not the talk, It's the fear and anxiety and shyness. That's the real. That's what's important. And so then, as I accept the feeling, and that's been the particular kind of knot in my psyche. As I accept that and I witness to that, then that's the first seed of peace, the first seed of equanimity. Compassion is very helpful. Kindness is very, very helpful. And then if I keep, and that's what I've done, I just keep put that seed in, acceptance, body awareness, and keep doing that, then the causes for fear, in this case, it might, you know, there's all kinds of things we suffer from, but the causes for fear are no longer being put into the stream of consciousness. You know, if I run away, you know, if Ajahn Sumedho asked me to do a 10-day retreat in 1978. Oh, I was so afraid. I was in the toilet all the time. I barely made the retreat, right? I just didn't know what I was going to say. But I said, "Well, okay, he's asked me. I'll give it a go." So within the fear, there was enough wisdom that said, "Well, you just got to face it sometime, mate." And he encouraged me. He said, "Well, what am I going to say? Well, in 10 days." He said, "Well, you know a little bit more than that. It'll be all right." And it was an absolute agony. I mean, it was really just not a pleasant experience. But the thing was, the first seeds of acceptance of fear were being planted. So the experience itself was just really. You can't imagine how unpleasant it was. It certainly wasn't constipated, that was sure. But if that's the karma of the mind, you know, who wants it? But there it is. So it's like you can't get rid of this stuff through some act of will. We certainly tried that. But so it's like accepting the whole program. And this is where the word... non-attachment gets a bit confusing, because non-attachment sometimes almost seems to people like you don't feel anything, but you do. So non-attachment is actually full feeling, but not getting caught in the storyline sense of self. So in terms of not self, say if the question of if there is no self, which is not the question the Buddha has asked, the question of no self is, yes, actually, if I just observe fear, I can't find a fixed person in that. I can find energy, I can find perception, I can find thought, I can find vedana, feeling, but I can't find this thing called me in it. And that establishing of objectivity is non-attachment. It's not saying anything about the energy of fear. That's just the karmic result of whatever my life was before that. So if once one establishes objectivity, and the way we establish objectivity is by saying, or by disengaging with the storyline, okay, in developing equanimity, accepting the way things are, the full feeling of it. Again, if we can be in the body, that's very, very helpful. And then introducing the language of Buddhism is this will change. Because what is really difficult about the things we're trying to be equanimous around is the sense of permanency that we put onto it. Oh no, there's that fear again. And then, you know, it's going to be there forever. So then we introduce language, and that's a huge thing, isn't it? When I'm caught up with some state of mind which has always blown me away, and I say, this will change, already I have some objectivity. Whereas when I'm wrapped up in the storyline, then there's no objectivity. I am the fear, totally. Haven't got the distance. We've got to get the distance, introduce the language of change, and then really like feel it. Investigate the feeling. Where is fear? So then I just learned, oh, fear is in the guts. Throat contracts. Then developing skillful means around the thing that you are not equanimous with. So I mean, I can only talk about my own. The kind of major thing in my psyche around fear. For you, it might be anger or doubt or whatever. So you kind of have to figure out your own path. But then, what is the problem with fear? So you go back to the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering. There's the cause of suffering. There's the end of suffering. And there's the path that leads to the end of suffering. Suffering has to be understood. The cause has to be abandoned. The end has to be realized. And the path has to be developed. So then the inquiring mind says, well, what's the suffering here? Well, I'm afraid. But that's not the Buddha's teaching. Is what is the cause of suffering? Is the cause of suffering is the attachment to craving. And if you take the teaching and you use the methodology of questioning that the Buddha presented, the solution is there. When all else fails, read the instructions. Go back to the Four Noble Truths. Gordon Homer. So you go back, and we do get overwhelmed with this thing. Okay, Four Noble Truths, what's the problem? What's the fear? No. What's the craving? What is it? Oh, I don't want the fear. That's the problem. The fear I've got no choice around. That's just the karmic momentum of this mind. So what's the problem? It's the not wanting. And that was a big insight. Although my teachers could tell me that. My teacher said, just welcome it. Yeah, welcome it. Yeah, good for you. Don't make it a problem. It'll change, yeah. So, it's all true what teachers tell you, but sometimes. But then the insight comes, and it's, that's the problem. It's the not wanting of the fear. So then, developing a strategy around the wanting. Okay, I'll welcome the fear. And then the welcoming works first two times. And then the third time, I'll welcome you. Yeah, and the mind is clever and quick. So you keep working with it. And then begin to have metta for the fear. Kindness for the fear. And all of that begins to be the foundation for equanimity. The kind of little seeds of first of all, this is what it feels like. Objectivity. This will change. Then discovering that the problem is not the emotional content of the karma. It's the not wanting or the wanting of something else. And it's that wanting bit that we need to understand. That's where the inquiring comes. And then seeing, okay, that's the not wanting, which is a repressive kind of energy. Vibhavatana, not wanting. Okay, I'll welcome it. I'll try that. And getting better and better at it. And then, of course, the power of the fear gets less, and then the tools that one has developed around that get better and better, more honed, more and more skillful. But all the time, then equanimity is being cultivated around this. One's developing patience. One has faith. This will change. All those things come into play, and then the power and the whole nature of fear is no longer being karmically motivated, because one's volition is no longer from fear, and karma is volition. And as long as I'm not putting any volition from fear into consciousness, then that has to die, and it ceases more and more. So then the realization of the end of suffering, you begin to see, actually fear is not suffering. It's the not wanting of fear. Fear is unpleasant. The Vedana is unpleasant, but is unpleasant suffering, or is it my desire for the pleasant? What's the problem? And that is, of course, important in Buddhism too, is that it's not, the path isn't one of having pleasant sensations, because that's not life. You have to be a Martian for that. The path is knowing the pleasant and the unpleasant, the neutral, as something that comes and goes, of course, with causes and conditions. So that the happiness of the Buddha is unconditional. It's not conditional upon pleasant and unpleasant. So one begins to see, it's just unpleasant. And I mean, that takes a bit to get there. And the way one learns how to be with the unpleasant is like in a meditation, just being with the unpleasantness of a painful leg. Not to the degree where it hurts you. Or being with the unpleasantness of boredom or whatever it is. Oh, this is just unpleasant. and beginning to see where the craving is. That's the problem. Where is the craving? This is the way it is now. What's the craving? Rather than the problem is out there. The problem is in the mind as it's working. So equanimity is evolved first and foremost through understanding what non-equanimity is like in terms of greed, hatred, and delusion. It's very much helped by good samadhi. So the more you can have periods in your life where you do disengage with complexity, if you can, sometimes you can't. Life is just too complex. But if you can, then you do set up a kind of foundation of consciousness which has a steadiness and stability. So then when instability arises in terms of fear or anger, you see it much more quickly. If life gets too hectic, then it's kind of just survival again. One is just running around. Huh? And then to make that the project, to say, okay, if there's a lot of anger in the mind or a lot of self-disparagement or a lot of depression or a lot of fantasizing, whatever it is, okay, I'm going to work on that this lifetime. You know, you got to kind of... I've been working on fear for 30 years. So it's not like it's going to happen tomorrow. But if you make that determination and you make the right causes, it's got to unfold. And then the whole problem of non-equanimity, the whole problem of the aberrations of our mind and the kind of the bits that aren't so pleasant to be with and all that, then at least you've got this way of working with it. It's not, oh no, there's that fear again. Oh, I thought I went through that. No. No, I'm training with this. So you get this, you know, this word, ujjupatipanno, the what we chant, the kind of direct practitioner. You're really uju on your fear. You're really on the case because I'm going to train with this now. Really, oh no, poor me, no, that's the project. I wish I had another project. Fine. You can compare yourself and say, well, look at that guy. He's not afraid. Big deal. You got your project. You have to work with your project. And that determination to, well, okay, that's the way the mind's been conditioned. I understand causes. I mean, that can be helpful to understand one's childhood or where it's come from. That can be helpful. But in the end, one has to work with it in the present moment. And just that steady determination, you chip away, it's no big deal, but then the result is very good because you've really gotten to the roots of some of the basic things that cause you suffering. Sometimes on retreats you get the kind of epiphanies and explosions of mind, which are neat, but the grunt work, you're just kind of steadily grinding away. Both are good, but just that steady work is like the Buddha said, that the teaching is, the training is not, it's not a cliff that falls into the ocean. It's like a shallow beach that goes into the depths of the ocean. And that's just chipping away, taking responsibility for your own mind, being kind to yourself, obviously, and saying, okay, I blew it that time, but I'm going to keep trying. That has a lot of staying power. You can really stay with that, and the profits are great because if I can take the deepest form of my own contractions and work on them, then I'm going to get the deepest peace from that, aren't I? The usual way to look at it maybe is that, oh, I've got this fear problem. What am I going to do about my fear problem? And then kind of make a huge self out of it. But the Buddhist project is, okay, fear is a condition that obsesses the mind, that's what I'm going to work with. And I'm going to understand it and keep cultivating around it. So each of us has our own little or big programs that way, but the principle is the same. Understanding the Four Noble Truths, getting objectivity, seeing this change, understanding it in the body, these are very, very helpful things. And then developing the skills around that. All right, I'll leave that for tonight.